and welcome back to Poetry Pals.
I'm Megan.
And I'm Sophie. And today we'll be talking about a fun text set. But before we begin that, we're going to reflect on our last episode. Did you want to start?
Yeah. So some of the things that we talked about in our last episode, we brought up a lot of different social issues and a lot of different ways that they connect with our literature. And I think it's really important to note that, yeah, we did gloss over them a little. But the reason being is that our focus, while we do make those connections and while we do talk about them a little, it's really important to have those conversations more in depth with your students and allow them to make those connections mm-hmm. and allow them to work through those issues and develop in different ways mm-hmm. Versus really just kind of throwing it at them.
Right.
So we touch on them, but we don't go in depth for that reason. It's right. not that we don't care about the issues, and it's not that, you know, they're not important, and that they don't have a lot more depth to them. It's just that these conversations should be continued into a classroom and right. really, really dug into.
Exactly. Our purpose is to elaborate, or I don't know if that's the right word, like enumerate all the ways that you can connect these types of texts to social issues. And like, we went into, like, there are a ton of ways you can do it, and we went kind of shallow on some of them and deeper on others. And this is just to demonstrate that, like, there are all these ways you can connect, not to say, like, oh, we touched on absolutely everything there is to talk about within those. Like, you should introduce this idea to your students, maybe use this as inspiration, and then let your students find those connections, like Megan said, mm-hmm. and especially find ones that connect more to them. Like, obviously, what we talked about is stuff that we are passionate about, but yeah. your students are going to be passionate about different things. And then the other, like, more specific thing within that I wanted to touch on is I worry that, like, I glossed over the when I mentioned Slytherins are kind of like the police in the way that they are viewed by certain aspects of Wizarding Society or our society. And I think the word choice I used was, if an officer makes a bad choice, that's not excusable. And that's not what I meant exactly. Like, obviously, if an officer does something that results in the death of an innocent person, that's completely not okay. And what I was trying to say is that when we discuss this type of issue, there are people who will reject the fact that it even happens, that there is disparity and bias in the police force, and can feel like the entire institution is being attacked. And so when you're talking about that kind of stuff, you have to consider your audience and acknowledge the other side of it, which is that there are plenty of people who go into the force for good reasons and to help people. And that's why I brought that up. It's just that, unfortunately, it is an institution that draws in people who want to do bad things and abuse that power. And then the institution often justifies that behavior. And that's not okay. And I wasn't trying to say that's okay. I was just trying to say, when we look at issues like that, it's important to acknowledge all sides and consider that, like, who you're talking to, focusing on just the bad, like we were talking about, is not going to be effective. And that's the point I was trying to get across there.
Yeah, absolutely. Our main thing is that we don't want it to seem like, because of who we are as people and the backgrounds that we come from, that we're just brushing aside social issues because they don't matter to us, because that's not it at all. You know, we wouldn't be where we are if we didn't care. So, yeah, we just wanted to make it clear that we do care. And we really, I mean, it's, again, you know, we're just kind of touching on different ways, a lot of different ways. And we just don't have the time to go into them the way that they deserve. And that's what a classroom is for.
Right. And I mean, we have the time, but we are not going to shoot you a 4-hour podcast.
Yeah.
You don't have the time for that. So, yeah. All right, are you ready to jump into today's topic?
Yeah, let's get going.
Okay, so today we have developed a text set that really focuses on the nature versus science argument that's present in so many texts throughout history and is still, I mean, so relevant today.
Mm-hmm.
And the text that we're using is the Prometheus myth, which first appeared in Hesiod in the 8th century. So that one's pretty old. And then we're going to look at Frankenstein by Mary Shelley from 1818, The Birthmark by Nathaniel Hawthorne, which came out in 1846, and finally Jurassic Park. And we're looking at both the 1990 novel And we might dip into its sequel a little, as well as the 1993 film. And we are going to reference the films that have come after, because that is, I mean, it's a Jurassic Park has become just more than a series.
Mm-hmm.
I don't even know like the right word for it.
I know, it's sitting on the tip of my tongue.
It's iconic. It's something that resonated with so many people. Mm-hmm. And we're going to talk about the reason. Like in Jurassic Park, you see so many connections to these older and even ancient texts. Like, why are we still having this conversation? And that's something we want to talk about today, and that would be great to introduce to your students. And the reason we're using a text set is because it works on so many levels education-wise.
Mm-hmm.
So you can use this for differentiation. You can create text groups using different. Like if your students are at different levels, which most likely they will be, you can give some of them a shorter myth or even a video that explains the myth so they can connect that way. Frankenstein is for your higher level readers. And this, of course, depends on grade. Like I know sometimes they read Frankenstein in seventh grade now, which seems crazy to me because mm-hmm. I read it for the first time when I was 20 or 21.
Yeah.
And still I was like, I could not have appreciated this so much before now.
No, absolutely.
But I know kids read it in high school and understand it. So wherever your kiddos are at, if they can read Frankenstein, then by all means let them, because it's a wonderful novel. And then we have The Birthmark, which is a short story. So even though the language is a little challenging, it's still shorter. So many of your students can handle it. And then we have Jurassic Park. And you might, I don't know if many teachers would be interested in teaching the novel, because it's not the most exemplary writing, but it's a great story. So if your students are interested in it, that might be a way to get them involved in these ideas and then have them transition to texts like The Birthmark and Frankenstein, which are more canonical, if that's what you want to move them to. Or you can show the film. And I know that, is it R-rated?
I don't think so. I think it's PG-13.
I think so too.
As of today's standards, it borders a little.
Yeah. If it is acceptable, if it's something you want to show in your class, that's okay. Otherwise, students who, you know, and I guess maybe you wouldn't want to do a parent permission thing, because that does exclude certain students if their parents are like, bah, they can't watch this.
Mm-hmm.
But you could even show like clips.
Yeah.
That are school appropriate and integrate it that way. Because, I mean, it's such an important part of our cultural like society.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's something that a lot of kids will relate to, will like, and then you can use it to connect back to all these other things.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so you can use that for differentiation there. And then if you have those separate text groups, you can create a jigsaw and have all these students talk about the themes and other things that are present across all of these different types of texts.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what we're going for here. And then, like we touched on, it moves students from something that is current to something that's older, but still very, very relevant.
Mm-hmm.
And so to begin, we'll kind of talk about some general themes that we see in this text, and feel free to jump in wherever if you have comments. And then we'll talk about like the specific text and what we see in them. And some of these generalities are more specific to like two of the texts than the other, but a lot of them are present across all four of these texts. So we have leave what is dead, dead. Isn't that a great something to live by? But I mean, we see this currently, like zombies are so popular.
Oh yeah.
And so, I mean, people are constantly wondering, like what would happen if the dead reanimated.
Oh my goodness. Yes.
and then be careful what you create, especially because no one thing is in control. Like the characters, the main characters in these stories just make these very self-centered, only themselves in mind choices,
mm-hmm.
and do not think whatsoever about the consequences it'll have on other people, on the world, even on them in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah.
Well, and the thing about that is also, I mean, and we'll get into this a little bit more later, but it's, they don't even recognize that it's a possibility. You know, they are, you know, when people warn them, mm-hmm. it's just, nope, that's not a thing. I know exactly what I'm doing, and I know exactly how this is going to go down.
Right, yeah. And so what we're starting to get into is the idea of these Promethean figures in these stories. And obviously that comes from the original Prometheus myth. Do you want to talk a little bit about what the Prometheus myth is briefly?
Yeah. So, the Prometheus myth, Prometheus was one of the gods on Olympus. And he was charged with the task of creating man. So he created man from clay, very similar stories to our current biblical stories. And so he did all of this for humanity. He created them. And something that he did something, though, to piss off Zeus. Mm-hmm. He stole fire from the gods and gave it to humans. Mm-hmm. Now, this was something that gods had control over, and they weren't going to give it to humans. And it created some massive tension with Zeus. And Zeus, being the ruler of all the gods, punished him. So his punishment was to be strapped to a rock, where every single day he would have a giant eagle come and eat his liver. And by the end of the day, his liver would be regenerated. And then at sunrise the next day, the bird would come back and eat it again.
Yeah.
So it was a never ending punishment. I mean, up until later when new myths come about and he's released and whatever, but, it was his punishment for giving humanity something that gods felt was theirs.
Right.
So,
and I don't know how long it went on before, I believe it's Hercules who freed him eventually.
Yes, it was.
But for as long as it went on, it certainly seemed like a never ending punishment.
Yeah. I think it was centuries that it went
on. Oh, I'm sure. And I think, I forget if you mentioned this, but when he gave fire to humanity, of course he made the gods angry. Like mm-hmm. you talked about, because they were like, this is ours. The mortals can't handle this source of divine knowledge. Mm-hmm. But when he did that, he enabled progress and civilization for mm-hmm. the humans. So there we have that. Like, did he do a good or bad thing? Because mm-hmm. Prometheus is often regarded as a hero.
Yeah.
And Zeus is regarded as like this kind of tyrant.
Oh, absolutely.
Who's trying to keep necessary, or maybe not necessary, but power from the humans that could help them.
Yeah.
And so this brings up a lot of stuff that we're going to talk about. So we'll connect back to this. So that's kind of the first text, the earliest text in our set. And that connects very directly to Frankenstein, because Mary Shelley subtitled her novel The Modern Prometheus.
Mm.
So right there on the title page, we have this connection. And it immediately prepares the audience to test this notion of playing with fire and playing God in the novel. And I think playing with fire, I'm sure, is a term that originally came from that.
Yeah, I would be surprised.
Yeah, and I mean, also,
find out differently.
I'm sure throughout history, kids have played with fire and gotten burned, and that's just a really common thing. Yes. But when we use it in this sense, it's definitely referring back to Prometheus and the idea that when he took the fire and gave it away, he was playing God. He was taking that higher position and going over the head of Zeus, who was like the top god.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, is that good or is that bad? So he shifts this power down to humans. And the question is, can they handle this responsibility?
Yeah. I mean, that's a huge overarching question.
Yes. And we see throughout all these texts, like the way that it's dangerous to trespass on God's creation or just nature. Definitely in Frankenstein and Prometheus, we see these direct connections to God or a God.
Mm-hmm.
And in The Birthmark and Jurassic Park, these more, The Birthmark is slightly more recent and the Jurassic Park is very recent. We see more just like focus on nature.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure God is referenced, but, a little less so.
Yeah.
And then we have this idea that it's difficult to stay away from something that's so appealing. Like, we have Prometheus's fire, we have the appeal in Frankenstein of using electricity to reanimate a dead body. And then we see in Jurassic Park using science to bring back the dinosaurs. And in The Birthmark, it's using science to remove a birthmark that nature put there and that turns out to be an intrinsic part of the person that it's on. And then you'll see that these Promethean figures that we're talking about, they tend to be male. We have Prometheus himself, Victor and Frankenstein, Ulmer, and then John Hammond is the original Promethean figure in Jurassic Park. And you could argue along with his scientists.
Yeah,
I think. But it's him that really has the vision and puts everything into play and insists that they keep going even when it's clear that it's a bad idea.
They're kind of the machine or the cause in the whole machine. They're just the little pieces that keep it running.
That's true. Well, and I like that you called them a machine because I think that will be relevant to other stories that we're going to talk about.
Yeah.
And so these characters are knowledge-driven. They think they're bringing a gift to mankind. They're selfish. They feel superior to others. And they have this secret knowledge that is reserved for godlike beings. And you'll see in a lot of these, especially this is super evident in Frankenstein, that Victor abandons the domestic space, which actually leads to his downfall. And these male figures go on these kind of journeys of discovery. You see that in Frankenstein. You see that with Prometheus leaving, like, what is it, Mount Olympus?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that plays super smoothly in that one, but it's true. He goes down to where the humans are and leaves, like, the space where he lives. And then we see that in Jurassic Park, John Hammond isn't living in, like, a home space at all. He's living in a, like, Disney World, like, place that's for profit. And you actually see the idea of domesticity in his grandchildren. And they kind of end up, like, saving things.
Mm-hmm.
They play a huge role in, like, saving everyone, which is interesting to look at. And so these figures, they have the opportunity to go in accordance with or against God's wishes. Usually they go against.
More often than not.
Yes. And it's once that they trespass into that divine knowledge, it can be used for good or for evil. And it's kind of like these characters are so in their own heads, thinking selfishly, thinking what they can gain from their choices, that perhaps they don't even realize they're doing it for evil, but they are.
Oh, absolutely.
They become these evil figures. And so we have just the idea of going beyond what was previously known about science. And again, this comes a lot more clearly in Frankenstein. Like, science is a very modern idea.
Mm-hmm.
So Prometheus is more just like the general kind of plot line.
Yeah.
And then we see it connect to a lot of these more modern plot lines. But what you see in Frankenstein, The Birthmark, and Jurassic Park is this booming of scientific discovery and how these characters, they move too fast.
Yeah. Well, and they're trying to outdo its limits.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. They don't recognize limits. And so you see in going beyond science, they're manipulating nature.
Mm-hmm.
And that is kind of like the line that they cross.
Yeah.
Like, it's trying to, like, surpass nature. And that's what is always these characters' downfall, is that they're not thinking about the consequences in nature. Because, I mean, and we talked about, we introduced this text set as a nature versus science text set. And that's really what it comes down to. Like, is nature or science going to overpower the other? Mm-hmm. And science is constantly trying to outdo nature. And oftentimes it doesn't work out well for the people involved. And then especially in these stories, it is very bad for them. And it brings up the question, like, just because you can, does that mean that you should?
Mm-hmm.
Which is that very famous quote in Jurassic Park, but that we see in these other texts as well. And so these Promethean figures, to kind of recap, they steal fire, or in Victor's case, this literal electric spark. In The Birthmark, Ulmer is using his scientific knowledge to constantly try and do the next big thing. You'll see, we'll talk about, he tries to create the elixir of life, and though he claims to respect life, he's always trying to avoid mortality and erase any symbol of mortality from his life and the things around him using science. And so it's at first seen as benefiting mankind. And that's what all these characters think they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
They're trying to benefit mankind. But a lot of the time, these laws of nature are thought to be like belong to the divine alone, and mere humans shouldn't have it. So that's, you know, the question, like, do we deserve it? Can we handle the responsibility? And then so these characters, they create these things thinking that they can control them, or that they can control nature, but of course they can't. They end up fearing them, and ultimately in the case of Victor and the people in Jurassic Park especially, they try to oppress them in this attempt to control. And it really is like playing with fire. I think that phrase is so apt that it runs out of control. Like when life and nature are, you try to contain them, you try to suppress them, as soon as they get out, it's just destruction. So, like, you see this in Jurassic Park, as soon as the dinosaurs get out, they spread like fire and can no longer be contained. And they start destroying the island. They start destroying people. And it's talked about how this scientific discovery, it comes out of chaos. And we see this, there's a really popular scene in Jurassic Park with the scientist Ian Malcolm, or I guess he's not a scientist, he's a mathematician.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting that he's the voice of rationale through all of this. Like right away when he arrives, he's like, this will not work.
Yeah.
Like, this is going to be bad, and let me tell you why. And he talks about chaos theory. and he predicts right away that, the island will quickly, behave in an unpredictable way, and that it's just an accident waiting to happen. And so chaos theory, obviously I'm not a scientist, and I'm going to give a very short, very undetailed little tidbit of what it is. But generally it's that though there is an underlying order to chaos, people can't detect it, and we can't predict more than a few seconds into the future because there are all these small irregularities that can have a huge effect that we don't account for in these predictions. And I believe, I was talking to you about this before we started, that that underlying order is nature. And so we can't understand it. So why are we trying to mess with it?
Yeah.
At least in these stories.
I mean, we can't track it. Yeah. Nature's unpredictable. It's constantly changing. Mm-hmm. I mean, so it's not even just little measures that we haven't taken into consideration. It's measures that we can't take into consideration.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
There's no way for us to know. I mean, how many times have we heard scientists say that nature's unpredictable?
Mm-hmm.
And so there's nothing, I mean, we can't trace certain things. And it's hard to figure, I mean, it's hard to figure things out when it's constantly changing, constantly adapting.
Yeah. And then especially when we do things that change it, how can we possibly know how it's going to retaliate?
Yeah.
Because that's what nature does. This comes up a ton in Jurassic Park. It's like nature defends itself.
Yeah. I mean, we're adding an element into something that is going to then take that and adapt it for its own uses.
Mm-hmm.
So how can we know how that's going to work?
Yeah. And how far can we go before nature will get us back?
Yeah. Before it takes it and uses it against us.
Yeah. And so we talked about Prometheus. Let's talk a little bit about what the birthmark is about. So we have this scientist who we've talked about, Almer, and his beautiful wife, Georgiana, who he thinks is perfect, except for she has this birthmark on her cheek. And for him, it ruins her. He sees it as the symbol of mortality, which he is doing everything to try and avoid. And so in his lab, it's interesting, it notes that he's made these stunning discoveries about volcanoes, fountains, mines, other natural wonders.
Mm.
And it emphasizes that he's made these discoveries about nature, but he wants to get back to his studies of the creation of life. So that's what he's interested in. He's interested in, like, am I capable of creating life? It talks about how he tries to create an elixir of life, tries to make himself immortal. But the thing is that his achievements always fall short of the goals that he originally sets. And you see this throughout the story. And though he claims to respect life, his actions show that that's not true.
Yeah.
I mean, he looks at what nature gives him, this beautiful woman, and says, oh, that birthmark on your cheek, it's got to go.
It's not good enough.
Yep. And then what's interesting is we have this other character, Aminadab, and he is Almer's assistant. And he is described as grotesque, uncouth, uncivilized. And he represents this closeness to earth and to nature. And when Almer tells him he wants to remove the birthmark, he goes, no.
Mm-hmm.
That's what makes her beautiful. You can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
And so he recognizes the, like, individuality that nature gave Georgiana and refuses to mess with it.
Mm-hmm.
He knows it's bad news. And what's interesting is that Almer refers to him as a man of clay, as an earthly mass. So we see these connections about why he is this, like, earthly person in contrast to Almer's rush for science and progress and discovery.
Yeah. Aminadab feels kind of like the heart of nature. Mm-hmm. I mean, not even just an advocate for it, but as if he is almost nature himself. I don't know why he feels that way to me, but that's, it's just that, you know, clearly it's not that science in and of itself is a problem.
Right.
I mean, he's working with a scientist. Mm-hmm. It's not that that's the problem. It's that when science is trying to circumvent nature, not even mm-hmm. necessarily surpass it. I mean, yes, surpass it, but also just go around its laws. I mean, think about the elixir of life.
Mm-hmm.
That is entirely circumventing nature, and mm-hmm. it's our natural course.
Right.
And so it's just when science tries to, break nature's rules,
yeah.
that it becomes a problem.
Yeah, definitely. And it's hard because, like, what we were talking about with Prometheus, like, I think especially now, and we're getting a little bit into why this is so relevant, like, when people criticize industrialization mm-hmm. because of the impact it has on the environment, which granted is bad.
Mm-hmm.
We did, like, I don't know the exact number, but it's like we did, like, millions of years worth of damage in a span of, like, 50 years.
Yeah.
Something like that. Something really dramatic. But it allowed us to get where we are today.
Mm-hmm.
It allowed us to progress to this, like, better version of society. We have more knowledge. But is that knowledge tempered by, and it's, I don't want to call it reason, because I know that in the time at least Frankenstein was written, like, reason and intellect are, like, the same thing,
mm-hmm.
and it needs to be tempered by emotion. But I guess maybe, like, rationality that goes
yeah.
with emotion, it needs, so, like, that intellect is, like, it's good, it's a good thing, but it needs to be tempered by emotion and rationality. And that's why when we talk about, like, these Promethean figures tend to be male
mm-hmm.
and they leave the domestic space, you see, especially in Frankenstein, Walton gets letters from his sister
yeah.
and his sister, like, wants him to come back. We see that, the men in the stories, especially Victor Frankenstein, when he pulls away from his family and from the domestic space and from the women in his life, that's when he goes crazy.
Yeah.
Because he's all intellect, no emotion. And it's always, I would argue that Mary Shelley argues that men in a lot of ways need women to temper them.
I mean, no, absolutely. I mean, because even think about the creation, the creature. I don't want to call him a monster because it doesn't feel right.
But, no, and Mary Shelley doesn't call him a monster. The idea of him being a monster is more cultural than it is textual.
Yeah, and so, but this creation, he wants a wife.
Yes.
That's part of it. I mean, and that, so not only does Victor lose it after leaving his family behind, which just totally destroys the balance that he once had.
Mm-hmm.
However fragile it may have been, that balance has, I mean, he has snapped.
Mm-hmm.
But the creature's desire for a female companion,
mm-hmm.
that's trying to create another balance.
I know.
And it forces a snap when Victor refuses.
Yeah, and that's a super interesting aspect of Frankenstein that that the creature does. He desires companionship, and he tries to connect with, like, humans.
Mm-hmm.
But he is so clearly not human. However much, it's so weird because we've talked about how the creature – well, we haven't talked about it here. But many people have talked about how the creature actually has, like, a pretty rich emotional understanding.
Mm-hmm.
And he craves closeness with people, like not even necessarily romantic closeness, but mm-hmm. he wants love from Victor, who originally rejects him, and then from the family who he watches and learns from.
Mm-hmm.
He gets all this intellect from them, but he doesn't get any reciprocation of emotional feelings.
Yeah.
They also reject him. Every human he encounters rejects him. And he thinks that if Victor makes him a wife who is like him, he'll finally have someone who will accept him. However, I wonder if Victor had gone through with that, because he starts building the mm-hmm. bride and then destroys her because he's like, I can't bring another one of these into the world.
Yes.
It's like he almost at that point, like he has sort of learned his lesson.
In a way.
A little bit. Like he's at least started to learn his lesson and realize what he's done. But then, of course, by destroying the bride, he angers the creature mm-hmm. even more. This was like, as the creature sees this as his one chance at happiness. But I wonder if Victor had gone through with that and created the woman creature and awoken her the way he had awoken the creature, she would have been at the same stage the creature was originally.
Mm.
And I don't know if they would have been compatible.
That's true.
Because he's come so far ahead, and now she would be the savage one.
At the same time, though, maybe he could have. I mean, we'll never know. Because she was never created.
Victor's an idiot.
Maybe he could have gotten her to his point. You know, showed her things and then kind of taught her how he worked through it.
Yeah.
And how they can help each other. I mean, again, we'll never know. So it's yeah. entirely speculation. But
yeah.
There's this part of me that feels like that balance and that just that companionship and love from someone mm-hmm. May have helped.
Yeah. But then I wonder, would he have come to resent her because she had what he didn't?
I don't know, because she would have given it to him.
Yeah, but
in the end,
that's true. Yeah, and I mean, of course, it's
super
complicated discussion. I don't know. I just don't know about that, and like the idea of the emotion that's left out when these people only focus on intellect. They're not completely thinking.
Yeah.
Is the point?
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah,
it's that nurture aspect of life.
Yeah, and we're definitely going to get into nature and nurture very soon.
Oh, yeah, we've got a lot of that.
And so, anyway, we were talking about the birthmark.
Yes.
And, like I mentioned, he has these great dreams, but his achievements always really, like, fall short of, like, the goal he sets. And so he tries all these things to remove the birthmark with, like, his potions and I don't want to call it spells, like alchemy stuff. I almost called it a spell. That would be incorrect. That's not science. And nothing works. And he even says that he can tell the mark goes deep into her body. It's clearly an essential part of her. And he even has this like super foreshadowing dream that he tries to cut it out and it goes all the way down to her heart.
Mm.
And yet just by that, like for a reader, I think for me, that's a very evocative moment. Like
yeah.
It's very pathos. And I feel moved by that. And
yeah.
if I when I read that dream, I'm like, oh my gosh, you can't cut it out. It's connected to her. It's connected
yeah.
to her heart. This obviously very like symbolic piece of emotion
mm-hmm.
in her, and he's not thinking emotion, he's thinking all intellect, and he's like, I gotta get rid of it. It's a symbol of mortality. It's I don't know. I was gonna say like grinding my gears or something like that, but that's a bit of an understatement.
Yes.
he's like, it's harshing my mellow, it's just gotta go. yeah, so even despite that, he's like, oh, we're still gonna get rid of it. And it's so interesting. A quotation that I wrote down was, thus ever does the gross fatality of earth exult in its invariable triumph over the immortal essence, which in this dim sphere of half development demands the completeness of a higher state, which I think essentially is saying that like the earth exults in that he tries so hard to achieve, you know, immortality. He tries so hard to get rid of what nature put on his wife. And it ends with her dying.
Mm-hmm.
He was not able to do what a higher power would be able to. And there's the reference to God in this one, or at least some higher power.
Yeah.
Nature is like, you can't overpower me.
Yeah.
Georgiana dies saying, you have rejected the best the earth could offer. And I think that's very important because when we think about things that are natural, we might sometimes think they are flawed, but really, like, it's what years and years of evolution have produced. So it's like the best, really,
yeah,
in a lot of situations. Like, how could someone, at least in this context, like, criticize that? And it's mentioned that she's perfect for a fleeting moment, and then she dies.
It's so heart-wrenching.
It is, yeah.
I mean, oh my gosh, that piece about you have rejected the best the earth could offer. I mean, you've rejected life itself,
mm-hmm,
at this point. I mean, not even just with the elixir of life, but this piece of her. I mean, that, like you said, that dream where it goes directly to her heart. I mean, you would think that someone would be like, this is part of her life.
Right.
And it doesn't matter. He's rejected life itself in every form.
Right. And what I've kind of left out, actually, of this whole summary is how upset Georgiana is, mm-hmm, when she learns that he doesn't like her birthmark.
Yeah.
She is so upset throughout this whole process, and she finally agrees to get rid of it because that's her husband. And at this point, of course, she's going to do anything to keep his love of her.
Yeah.
When really, selfishly, all he really cares about is the science.
Yeah.
All he cares about is doing the next big thing, and he's using his wife as a subject.
Yeah.
And that's very similar to what Victor does. He claims to love his creature before he makes it. And like, as he's making it, he gets feverish with like this, like, almost obsessive love for this thing he's creating,
mm-hmm,
for his child. And then as soon as he gives it life, he's disgusted,
mm-hmm,
and he runs away and rejects it, kicks it out on the street, essentially. And like, it's clear in these two examples that these men are just all intellect, no emotion.
Yeah. I mean, just no, not even just no emotion, but no respect for life and for nature. Mm-hmm. It is all about, mm-hmm, furthering their own gains through their own means.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So.
Yes. So, yeah. So we're going to move into a little bit about the idea that comes up in Frankenstein. Is the creature innately bad? Is he born bad? Or is he made bad? And that's something that's questionable throughout the series. the novel. We were talking about nature versus nurture. And at this time, like, there was a lot of, like, normal philosophy going on along with the natural philosophy, which is the science. And people like Rousseau and whoever, I can't remember which one did the blank slate one.
No, I don't remember.
Oh, well. Well, there's this idea of, like, blank slate where people are born blank, and it's the nurture that affects who they become,
mm-hmm,
and whether they're good or bad. And then there's the people come out, I don't know, is it bad? Something like that. But the idea of, like, a blank slate, like, did the creature come out a blank slate, and did people make him bad by treating him badly?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, regardless of that, like, the creature's actions.
John Locke is the blank slate.
Oh, perfect. Okay. And then I'm pretty sure Rousseau might be the other, like, the counter to that.
Might be.
Sorry. No, it's okay.
Just
no, you're fine. I was saying the way that, like, regardless of the way people treated him, like, his actions are not excusable.
No.
Like, what he ends up doing is, in order, he continually tries to get Victor's attention and his love, and he can't. So he kills Victor's bride, mm-hmm, on their wedding night, which, oh my gosh, sorry, tangent, but this is really interesting. I just picked up a book today that is called, like, The Dark Descent of Elizabeth Frankenstein,
oh,
which is about Elizabeth Lavenza, and I am so excited to read it. So while we're talking about relevance, this is like a new book. Like, obviously, yeah. Frankenstein is still relevant. I care so much. I'm so excited to read it. But yeah, I mean, and again, that's like, you know, the woman in the story.
Yeah.
Elizabeth is the main woman in their story. And because the creature doesn't know what else to do, he kills Victor's wife, mm-hmm. which, like, that's also his cousin, so that's creepy. So maybe it was for the best. But I guess at the time it wasn't creepy.
No, at the time it was totally normal.
Yeah. So yeah, and like, so the creature, regardless of this, his actions are not excusable. But Victor did a bunch of really bad things too, and Victor made the creature feel terrible.
Yeah. Well, not he. It's like rejecting a child.
Yes.
That's what this is. He has created this being and kicked him to the curb because he was afraid of what he had just done.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, buddy, buck up and be a man and figure this out. You know, instead, he runs from his problems.
Yes.
He runs from his creature, and his creature is literally telling him, the only thing I want is for you to acknowledge me and for you to love me. You've created me, you've put me here, so do something about it.
Yeah.
And instead, he kicks him to the curb.
Well, yeah, and I mean, and when we're talking about this idea of, like, overdoing what you should scientifically, that's what Victor does. He could not handle mm-hmm. what he created, and so it started coming after him,
mm-hmm.
and it started killing the people around him. It kills, like, I think, like, his little brother and like his best friend, and then finally Elizabeth.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually, though indirectly, it kills him.
Yeah.
And that, you know, when you try to outdo nature, it is going to come after you.
Yeah.
That's the message we can gain from that. And so, but the question that comes up is like, if you treat something bad or you expect it to be bad, is that what makes it bad? Mm. And so we were talking about like dinosaurs. Dinosaurs are in Jurassic Park are very different than the creature, because the creature has this human reason,
mm-hmm.
and he does have that emotional part and intellectual. And so he does have the capability to be good, but do dinosaurs have the capability to be good?
Well, and I think that what we were talking about earlier is that good and evil is almost subjective in this sense. Because it is entirely reliant upon a human consciousness of what good and evil is.
Mm-hmm.
Animals are driven by instinct.
Mm-hmm.
They don't consider when they're hunting a baby animal, well, this is someone's baby. They don't have that concept.
No, of course not.
It's, this is my dinner, right. You know?
Yes.
And so it's not, I don't know that dinosaurs do have that capability, because dinosaurs are animals like any other,
mm-hmm.
and they are going to react to situations to protect themselves, to
exactly.
survive,
yeah.
and to do what needs to be done. And
exactly.
it's not that process of I'm intentionally going after something to hurt it. It's
yeah.
I need to eat because I need to live. So this
yeah.
is what's going to happen.
Yes. But then we have in the whole Jurassic Park series, we have these people who, as soon as dinosaurs are created, they are in awe of them,
mm-hmm.
but they also fear them.
Mm-hmm.
And they do, they expect them to be bad, which, like you said, yes, dinosaurs have these instincts to kill,
mm-hmm.
Which makes total sense. But if people weren't going in there and messing with the dinosaurs,
mm-hmm.
it wouldn't be an issue in the first place.
No.
And so it's really the humans kind of bringing destruction down upon themselves by even bringing the dinosaurs back into the world in the first place.
You made your bed, now lie in it.
Yes. And so, but then we were also talking about in Jurassic World, which, I mean, the series is so influential, so popular that they have continued making it, even though now I would argue that the films are not as good.
Yeah.
I think the new ones aren't great, but I also get it. I mean, total spoiler, but like the ending of the last one was finally, after all this time, the dinosaurs have stopped being contained just to the island. Like, you know, we start out, they're contained on the island,
mm-hmm.
then they spread to the island, and then we have, oh, now they're on a bigger island, but they're contained. Oh, now they're not contained.
Mm.
And then now we have the dinosaurs have come to the United States, and now we're in a place where people and dinosaurs have to survive together.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, so I see where they're getting, and it's kind of, I mean, it's like, it's a continually scary reality, and like not of actual dinosaurs, but of what they symbolize, which is what we're getting into. God, please, no one bring back dinosaurs. Like, we know now why this is such a bad idea.
We've seen it. Don't do it.
Yeah, seriously. But I mean, sorry. Back to the point I was trying to make, though. In Jurassic World, the dinosaurs are trained. And especially the velociraptors, which in the first few movies are like the most vicious, like yes, worse than a T-Rex, are able to develop a relationship with Chris Pratt's character. And so we see that they actually are capable of having a connection with a person, mm-hmm, like they might have with another dinosaur,
hmm,
and having that loyalty there. However, the villains in Jurassic World want to weaponize them and use them for evil.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not even that the dinosaurs are innately good or evil. It's now that we have them, how are we using them?
Exactly. Yeah. It's our intentions with them,
yeah,
that matter.
Yeah. Like, we have that awful guy in the first Jurassic World who wants to weaponize them and almost like program them to be used in the wars and defeat enemies.
Mm.
And he's like, well, and what's interesting is we've been talking about, like, what is more powerful, man or nature, or man-made weapons and nature. And it's almost like this villain is like, what if we could use this most powerful of nature's creations as a weapon?
Yeah.
And so it's almost like, I wonder if in a way he recognizes that.
Okay. Full disclosure, I've never seen Jurassic World.
Okay, that's fine. Well, but I'll give you a summary.
It almost is, from that, it seems as if he has some recognition of what nature can do, mm-hmm, and what, just not its abilities, but the significance of it,
mm-hmm,
and just how powerful nature is. Mm-hmm. But then it's turning around and, again, trying to break nature's rules. And trying to circumvent nature's laws and use it against each other.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. And one thing that comes up a lot in Frankenstein is, and we talked a little bit about this, the idea of like savagery, uncivilized versus civilized. And something that is clear through Frankenstein is that if it's savage versus civil, savage will always win,
mm-hmm,
if it's just them bare hands. But if the civil man has time to collect his machines, collect his weapons, then he can win.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really interesting that, like, nature is stronger to a point, but we are coming after her with weapons. And how long is it going to be before she's able to overpower us again?
Mm-hmm.
And then we see that in Jurassic Park and Jurassic World, like we were just talking about. And so another question we had about this whole thing is, which is scarier, to have a clear barrier between the human and the monster, or to have them almost be equals? So we see this really clearly in Frankenstein. We have the creature who's supposedly the monster, mm-hmm, but we've already said, for the most part, he has a better sense of moral judgment than, mm-hmm, Victor does. It's just occasionally he spirals into a rage. And again, not justifying his actions, but he does like spiral into rages before he kills.
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost like when it just gets so much out of his control that, yeah, he can't think clearly and rationally anymore,
mm-hmm,
and use that emotional part of him to stop himself. He just goes crazy. Whereas Victor, like we've talked about, is selfish, has no consideration for other people's feelings.
Yeah.
And so, like, who is really the monster there? Is the big question.
Honestly, to me, in answering this question, blurred lines are the scariest thing for me. If there's a clear enemy to defeat, you know what needs to happen. But when those lines are blurred and now you don't know who's at fault. I mean, especially if you're in the situation and you don't know who the enemy is, if it's you or if it's someone else, that's terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
That is, I just, it, to me, that's why Frankenstein is so, I mean, the novel of Frankenstein is so hard for me to work, mm-hmm, through sometimes, because it does, it blurs every line that you think should exist, every, yeah, barrier, every clear cut piece of information that should help you mm-hmm. in really accepting the story and really digging into it is gone.
Yeah. And I mean, it makes me like think like, is it worth to look monstrous or to act monstrous, which is what we have going on. Like, we have the creature who looks terrifying mm-hmm. and everyone rejects him because of his looks. But he, for most of the novel, is like a good person.
Mm-hmm.
He is kind and like empathetic almost.
Yeah.
Like he's been kind of like through the worst so he can feel for other people.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas we have Victor, who again is just like, I'm sorry, I'm hating on Victor, but that's just how I feel. He's just an awful person and he treats the creature badly. He treats other people in his life badly. The whole time he's pushing people away in favor of his scientific discoveries. And so it's almost like in actions, if you total like the negative actions throughout the novel, I would guess that Victor is more monstrous.
Oh yeah. I mean, so the creature's monstrous acts are horrible. I mean, they're horrendous. He kills people.
Right.
But look at everything that Victor did as well. I mean, it's not a tally system on who's worse and who's better or whatever necessarily, but it's...
No, I think it is. I think Victor's worse.
Okay, that's true. Okay. Okay, fair enough. Victor is worse.
In literature, I feel like we can say that. In real life, not as much.
In real life, no, you can't say that. But yeah, you're right. Look at everything Victor does.
And I mean, think about how I feel like he drives the creature to do what he does.
Oh, I mean, without a doubt. Without a doubt. If he gave the creature some sense of being cared for, I don't think anything the creature did would have ever happened. I think he just wanted something.
Like, he made it. Why can't he take care of it? he brought destruction down on himself, like we said earlier.
Absolutely.
And so, yeah, and so we see that same thing in The Birthmark, I think, where we have Almer, who is this prestigious scientist guy, and we have Aminadab, who's described as grotesque, but who's a better person? It's Aminadab.
Yeah, absolutely.
So who's really grotesque there? And that word, I'm not sure how it's used in that context, because in older texts, it tends to be used to mean shocking, like so different that it's shocking. But nowadays, we use it to mean like ugly, monstrous.
Yeah.
And sometimes that can mean the same, but I think they have different connotations.
Yeah. I mean, I think so. But I think either way that you read it, shocking or that monster and that terrifying being.
Mm-hmm.
I think one way or another, however you read it in this context, I think both apply and both work.
Yeah.
And neither one is going to detract from that message of that inner peace versus the outer.
So. Yes. And so we have that there. And then in Jurassic Park, we have the dinosaurs who many of the characters regard as monsters, but honestly, I know the viewers, I mean, tend to feel pity for the dinosaurs mm-hmm. in a lot of situations. Like we were talking about, like though they are killers, it's because that's their instinct. That's mm-hmm. not them weighing the pros and cons and being like, oh, it's immoral. Like they can't do that.
Mm-mm.
And so a lot of the time I feel pity for the dinosaurs that I'm watching, and I feel anger toward the villains.
Yeah.
Who are human in Jurassic Park. And we see starting with John Hammond, and then especially the two villains that I'm thinking of in Jurassic World so far, they focus only on how they can profit from nature and don't consider respecting it.
No.
And so John Hammond originally is like, think of all I can do. He finds like the capability to like extract dinosaur DNA, and he brings dinosaurs back and is only thinking of like, and I mean, I think he's already rich. So it's not necessarily like actual like monetary profit for him, but it's personal gain.
Yes.
Like he's going to be famous. He's going to be renowned.
Yes.
And you know, I think either Michael Crichton or the director of the films described, John Hammond does a dark Walt Disney.
Interesting.
I know.
I like it.
Not trying to suggest that Disney is evil. Well,
different conversation.
We won't go there. I'm like thinking of the Simpsons movie now. There's a reference to it. Okay.
Irrelevant.
Okay. But anyway, I mean, but he's this he wants to change the world. And like Prometheus, like Victor, like Almer, he thinks he's bringing good to mankind. He thinks he's bringing something innovative and helpful to mm-hmm. mankind, when really he's bringing destruction. And he walks around in his all light being like, oh, I'm the purest old man. But he's not, because he's thinking about personal gain.
I mean, think about in every single one of these stories, every single one, they have blinders on.
Mm-hmm.
There is no concept of anything other than I'm going to do this thing, and here's exactly how this is going to go down.
Mm-hmm.
There's no thought that even the tiniest little thing could go wrong. I mean, it's going to happen this way, and it's going to be perfect, and da-da-da-da-da. Like, everything, neat little ducks in a row.
Mm-hmm.
But every single one has blinders, because yes. every single one thinks that these things are going to happen, but they don't, and they won't. They right. never will.
Right. And I want to share two Ian Malcolm quotes now about the idea that nature is just, it's impossible to measure. It's impossible to anticipate.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about that earlier with the chaos theory. But one thing Malcolm says is, whatever it is you seek, you have to put in the time, the practice, the effort. You must give up a lot to get it. It has to be very important to you. And once you have attained it, it is your power. It can't be given away. It resides in you. It is literally the result of your discipline. And I remember in the novel, there's a much longer passage where he talks about the years and years and years of scientific discovery that built up to this. And the current scientists, they're not thinking about that. They're not thinking about all the discipline, all the effort that went in to get them to where they are now, where they can push the boundaries of science.
Mm-hmm.
They're not appreciating everything that went into it.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're making rash choices.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important to consider. And that's kind of why they are able to push the boundary, because we have all this scientific discovery, and it's amazing. And in a lot of ways, it's good for us. But if you don't consider like where it came from, where it built up from, and don't appreciate that, then you're more likely to exploit it.
There's something that keeps kind of niggling in the back of my brain about all of this.
Mm-hmm.
Nature evolves. Nature adapts, and it evolves, and it grows. So does science.
Mm-hmm.
Science is no different. Industry is no different.
Mm-hmm.
We all grow and adapt and evolve, same as nature. And so not only is it that making of rash choices and that absolute lack of consideration of everything that went into it. I mean, look how long it took to get from point A to point B. You may have the resources at point B, but you still need to take the time
mm-hmm.
to get to point C. You mm-hmm. can't just, okay, we're here, we're good. Now I know what I need.
Mm-hmm.
And nature is the same way. Like, look at the dinosaurs. The dinosaurs react the way they do because of the environment that they were originally in.
Right.
They have not adapted to humanity. They
no.
have not grown with us and seen these changes. So they are reacting purely on primal prehistoric instinct.
And even the actual, like, physical environment, like, beyond the, mm-hmm. like, the fact that there are humans, like, the atmosphere is different.
Oh, my gosh.
And the scientists drop the dinosaurs in there without any consideration for how they are going to function in that.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of the dinosaurs have breathing problems. It talks about in Jurassic Park how they put in plants that are poisonous to the dinosaurs.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't think about, like, what that might mean, even if the dinosaurs don't actually eat the plants. They're eating things that are around the plants. And
mm-hmm.
so we have an issue with, like, dinosaurs getting sick. They're not thinking about what they're doing, and they move too fast. And another Malcolm quote that I think could just apply to all of these scientists, including Frankenstein and Almer, is they have what I call thin intelligence. They see the immediate situation. They think narrowly, and they call it being focused. They don't see the surround. They don't see the consequences. And that's what we've been talking about this whole time, like
mm-hmm.
not thinking about the consequences, just jumping to what they think will make them great,
yeah.
whether that's through money, through power, through fame, all those things that kind of tie in together that these men want.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, so we're talking about the idea of, like, the villains and, like, who's really a monster
mm-hmm.
in these stories. And what actually, like, the results, like, what happens in the end of these stories, I think is so interesting.
Oh, yeah.
And so what we have is, and one thing I want to note, Is the idea while we're talking about nature is that, you know, the creature is like spliced, like he's all these different bodies put together and then animated, but they don't really fit together. And I feel like that idea plays into like what we were just talking about, the idea of like throwing all these prehistoric things together without considering how they would have fit together in the past. It's just throwing them in to make them look good, right? And or like to make it interesting, but they're not thinking about like how they're supposed to fit together. And that's the same thing Victor does. So, and then Victor, of course, looks at his creation, which he originally thought was beautiful. Like Victor had this feverish, almost obsessive love for his creation as he was making it. But then as soon as he animated it, as soon as he woke it up, suddenly it became disgusting to him because of that, you know. I mean, he's putting together pieces that don't fit together. And he recognizes that. And unfortunately, his response is not right. Like in, you know, the real world, like even if your baby maybe comes out like not looking so cute, like you don't just like reject it, you know. Although I suppose in like the animal world that probably happens. Victor's a human, so he should know better. And so he immediately rejects it and calls the creature later an abomination of nature, which is super interesting. And so then similarly, we have the dinosaurs are part dinosaur DNA and part amphibian DNA. So like just like the creature, they are spliced together and they fight back against like the environment that they're plunked into that isn't right for them. And of course, like nature always fights back. And so what we have here is like a look at these creatures that despite being supposed abominations of nature, despite being somehow unnatural, they actually integrate into nature better than the humans do and kind of the villains. Like I think Victor is sort of arguably a villain, though his case is a little bit kind of depends on the perspective.
It's a little bit of a gray area, but I mean, in terms of abandoning something you created because, oh, now all of a sudden it freaks you out. And entirely rejecting it. I mean, Victor arguably, not even arguably, Victor is the cause of everything that happens to the people around him. If he hadn't created the monster in the first place, nothing would have happened. And if he hadn't decided he wanted to play God. But B, if he hadn't rejected it, like, so I would definitely say that Victor's our villain in this.
He definitely is. And then similarly, we have these villains in Jurassic Park. For instance, in the first one, it's John Hammond. And then we have a few in the new Jurassic World movies who I don't know their names, but they're awful. They're the people who want to exploit the dinosaurs for profit and personal gain. And these people are alienated from nature despite being the ones who reject these like supposed freaks of nature who are then more integrated into nature than they are. Did that make sense?
That's
a bit of a windy explanation. But so it makes you think about like what is the status of nature? And that's what we've been talking about this whole time. You know, like nature fights back, and nature ultimately in these stories ends up overthrowing in a way the manpower. And that's what we want to talk about, and we're getting into it. But so it's also good to note that the villains in Jurassic Park have these poetically just deaths. And so we see this differently actually in the movie version of Jurassic Park and in the book. So in the book, John Hammond gets hurt and kind of lost alone and afraid one night. And he is eaten by compies, which are the smallest dinosaurs, and they're actually the dinosaurs that are there to eat waste. So they are like the lowest of the low, the lowest of the food chain. And John Hammond, after he's exploited all of his creatures, actually gets in the same situation as them. You know, he's in an environment he's not comfortable with. He's lost, alone, and scared, and he ends up getting eaten by these creatures, which is super interesting. And then we also have the Jurassic World villains are eaten. And then also in the original Jurassic Park, we have the greedy lawyer who, as soon as he sees the dinosaurs, goes, oh, you could charge anything to get in. $1,000 a day, $10,000 a day, people would pay it. He is the first to get eaten by a dinosaur, which seems like definite foreshadowing.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I got to say, on the John Hammond thing, not even just being eaten by your own creation, but being eaten by that type of dinosaur. I mean, that's just, I don't know. I can't.
It's poetic justice.
For sure.
Justice, if I've ever heard it.
Yeah. I mean, really, though, you know, I mean, to be eaten by something you create in and of itself is just kind of, wow, that sucks, dude. But at the same time, you're now being eaten by dinosaurs that their main food source is waste.
Yeah.
What does that say about you?
Yeah, well, truly. And then that his death in the book is different than at the end of Jurassic Park, the film. Mm-hmm. He actually leaves the island with the scientists and Ian Malcolm. And that's kind of interesting to look at. He ends up leaving his legacy behind. And you see there's a moment where he is like staring out over it, like he doesn't want to go, like he'd almost rather go down with it mm-hmm. than leave it, than abandon it. Which, I mean, that's kind of interesting when comparing him to Victor, how Victor abandons and rejects his creature right away, and John Hammond, even when it means death for him, is unwilling to do that.
Yeah, I mean, it takes someone pulling him away.
Mm-hmm. And so I think that's also interesting when you look at the characters of Victor and Walton in Frankenstein, who are thought by some critics to be doubles. So we have Walton, who begins the story. He's going on this journey of discovery to find the North Pole. And that's when he meets Victor. Victor tells him his whole story and then ends up dying on Walton's ship, being pursued by the creature. And I do feel like Victor has this very Promethean punishment mm-hmm. up until his death, where he is just running day after day repetitively from his creature, the creature he created. He's just continually running away from it up until he dies.
Mm-hmm.
And then Walton actually looks at this example that Victor sets and changes his mind and turns away from his journey, saving himself and the crew.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have these examples of Victor, who made the wrong choice and he dies for it, and then Walton, who ends up making the right choice. And there's some language at the very end of Frankenstein that talks about like a gentle breeze wafting him back the way that he came, back to the domestic space. And it is in direct contrast with the opening lines, where there's this icy, cold breeze. And it's almost as though fate is saying, yes, this is the right path. You're meant to go back. You're not supposed to pursue this scientific journey.
Mm-hmm.
And it's super interesting. And we were originally comparing John Hammond in the film to Walton, and John Hammond in the book to Victor. However, I still think John Hammond, like you were just saying, is pulled away from his park. He doesn't make the decision willingly like Walton does.
Yeah. Walton is definitely, he's actively realizing that there are consequences to actions. Mm-hmm. And that's not a price he's willing to make his men or himself pay.
Mm-hmm.
And it's worth it to just let nature be.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas Hammond still can't figure it out.
No. And I love the way you said that, let nature be. Like, these men are so, like we've talked about for most of this podcast, they're so focused on the personal gain that comes with this amazing discovery
mm-hmm.
that they do not think about the consequences. And Walton is willing to give that up. He's willing to give up the discovery in favor of like his survival and like letting the earth have something to itself.
Yeah.
Kind of.
Yeah. I mean, and we don't know, obviously, exactly what he would have done when he got there. You know, we don't know how much he would have messed with things or manipulated them,
mm-hmm.
but there's kind of this underlying sense of when you're going to go somewhere to discover something, you're going to rip it apart.
Right. And I mean, even just think about like conquistadors and like colonizers.
Oh, yes. That's the word.
People who go and discover, quote unquote, these new, quote unquote, countries
mm-hmm.
and end up destroying what they find. I feel like it's a similar thing. And so it's not just affecting the environment, it's affecting people.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a little bit different than in these stories where the focus is mostly on nature.
Yeah.
But it's a similar concept where like you can't walk there without causing destruction.
Yeah. Especially in terms of Walton with him and his men and that adventure.
Yes.
So.
And so what we're getting to is why is this still so relevant? And what we have come to is that, you know, nowadays, and this has been happening for years since the rise of industrialization, we exploit the earth for money and we don't think about the impact it will have on the environment or on ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Ian Malcolm has a lot of quotations about this, especially in the novel, but I believe in the film too, where he talks about, you know, we should care about the environment, but not for the sake of the environment. Like, the earth will be fine. The earth was here for billions of years before us, and it will survive us.
Mm-hmm.
Like, how long humans have been here for the earth is like 30 seconds or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So the earth will be fine, but we're actually killing ourselves off. And that's what I think many people don't realize.
Yeah.
And like, how, like, can we, save ourselves? And that's one of like the essential questions you can bring up with your students if you're using this text set. Like, has science gone too far? Can we save ourselves? But, it's important too, like we talked about earlier, think about the other side too, like where would we be without mm-hmm. scientific discovery? And it's important to recognize that, you know, we, like, without industrialization, without science, without some of the things that we've done that unfortunately are harmful, like, we wouldn't be where we are today as a society.
Mm-hmm.
And that's just like the story of Prometheus, where he gives the people fire and it allows them to become civilized.
Yeah.
It allows them to progress in a way that they could never without the fire.
Yeah.
But how do we seek a balance?
Yeah.
Where we can be civilized, or we can progress as a society without destroying ourselves.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and that's the thing, that balance is going to be the hardest thing to come across and the hardest thing to find. But I mean, we're going to have to, or we're going to die. I mean, mm-hmm. that's where we're at. Like you said, nature eventually overcomes.
Mm-hmm.
Without us interfering, the earth is going to figure itself out.
Mm-hmm.
But it's going to take getting rid of us, or for right. us to figure ourselves out and stop messing with it to the right. extent that we are.
Right.
So,
and I mean, the fact that, like, you know, there's talk of us using up like non-renewable resources, like on an earth time scale, they are renewable,
mm-hmm.
but in human lifetime, they are not.
No.
And so the rate at which we are using them, that's the problem.
Mm-hmm.
And of course there are counter arguments, you know, that like, if we are running out of something, like, there will be new discovery. And that's another place where innovation comes into play. But we also have to consider, like, the long-term effects of what we are doing to the earth, whether it's just resources or, you know, the environment as a whole, like, the air that we breathe literally
mm-hmm.
is being affected by what we're doing right now.
Yeah.
And I think this is especially timely at this moment when that report just came out about like how many years we have left to like figure out climate change, or we are going to just die, be done.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that's a bit like of a scary way to say it. It's not quite that sudden. It's not like one day it's just going to
yeah.
happen, but we are in like dire circumstances. And so especially right now, this is a great text set to discuss the environment. And like, you know, like we've talked about, the young minds that are hopefully going to save us mm-hmm. are in your classroom.
Yeah.
So it's important to have these types of discussions.
Yeah. Well, and it allows them to see things for themselves. You know, oftentimes, I mean, I know I did when I was a kid, I always just kind of latched onto whatever my parents said or the adults mm-hmm. in the room said. But something like this really allows students the opportunity to look at things on their own, depending on how you go about it. And I think it's a very unique opportunity to have them really start looking and thinking for themselves,
mm-hmm.
Which can be stepping out of a comfort zone.
Yeah.
And that's okay, but it's a matter of walking your students through it. But I think
right.
these texts open the door.
Yeah, for sure. And I love the idea. We've talked about this in previous episodes of like approaching these difficult topics through literature
mm-hmm.
and letting students examine it in a text in a space that's safely removed from them, and then think like, how does this transition to all our world?
Mm-hmm.
And again, like not doing what we've been doing, which is like we're stating our opinions, which is the purpose of this podcast.
Mm-hmm.
But you as the teacher in your classroom, you want your students to mm-hmm. state their opinions, and like Megan just said, like not go along with whatever you say is the authority.
Yeah.
And so these texts give a great kind of background for them to form their own opinions.
Yeah. And to really dig deep into it and I don't know, see it from their own lives and their own views, and who knows, maybe they'll change their minds, you mm-hmm. know. So
yeah, definitely. Well, is there anything else you want to add?
I think we're good. I think we've hit on a lot of stuff.
Yeah, definitely. Well, as always, please let us know if you have a different opinion or anything to add. And thank you so much for listening.
Yeah, we'd love to hear from you. So please respond and comment. And yeah, we will talk about it next time. All right. Well, I'm Megan.
And I'm Sophie.
All right. Thanks. And we will talk to you later.